When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. So I was at the Morningstar Annual Conference this week in Chicago at McCormick Place, and a couple of things struck me, which was pretty interesting. This is a conference. If you've ever been to Morningstar.com, they're the ones who created the Morningstar ratings for mutual funds, and they do a decent job of tracking through what mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, ETFs, and other kinds of bond funds, things that are going on out there. They do a pretty good shot of capturing that. They also do a lot of stock research. They do private research, all kinds of stuff. And they keep tabs on where portfolio managers are going back and forth. They also offer a whole bunch of calculators and tools that help you figure out what's going on. So once a year in June, they take over a big chunk of McCormick Place, which is the Chicago Convention Center, and they host their annual three-day plus a pre-conference conference for fund managers and different kinds of fund companies and other people. And so I went as a member of the press to spend some time and see what was going on. And it was pretty interesting. I haven't been to this conference in years. It's grown quite a lot. And I got to sit in on and listen to some people talk about where they see movement in the stock market, where they see different funds going, how they see investing changing. And most interesting for part of what I was doing was sitting and listening to one of their senior research people talk about how he looks at retirement in a little bit of a different way and how he thinks about planning for retirement, which is sort of interesting in an era or a week, should we say, that ended with the Dow at almost 17,000. It was up 171 points. It finished the week at 16,947. The fact that it's not at 17,000 in my mind is a rounding error, but this kind of relentless push forward, what does that actually mean, and why is it that people keep sending money into the stock market? The Fed pulled back a little bit again on its bond purchases, and yet the Fed still seems to be a little optimistic about where we are with the economy, and I keep hearing from people all over about how things just aren't as good as everybody thinks they are and that they're really suffering. And in fact, I could just go through my email this week, letter after letter after letter of people who just don't seem to be making it happen for themselves. They seem to be winding up in a place where they're not earning enough money to make it all work out, and they're in a situation where they just need help. They need all kinds of help. And so it's interesting to figure out what's actually going on here and why is it that the stock market is doing so well, and yet there seems to be this kind of on a personal level, people not doing as well as you think they might be. It's interesting to think about, right? So for anybody who owns stocks, boy, things have been fantastic, right? You can't imagine anything better. And yet, not so great for everybody else. Really very interesting discrepancy. And it speaks to this kind of dichotomy that we're seeing, right, between rich and poor and what's happening to the middle class. All kinds of interesting things going on. Anyway, over at Morningstar, a couple of things struck me as being worthy of having a conversation. And by the way, I should mention that the lines are open and be delighted to take your questions about anything. You know, money, houses, real estate, the fact that mortgage interest rates are dropping instead of rising. Very surprising and tied, I think, directly to the fact that in many states, we actually saw the unemployment rate go up and tick up a little bit. Some of the key states like Illinois went down a little bit, but it certainly isn't, the slam dunk that I think the Fed thought it would be. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. The other thing in my mind today is something that happened on the web over the last couple of days. And what happened was Move.com, which is a real estate site owned by the National Association. Well, I'm going to say it's owned by the National Association of Realtors, but that isn't actually accurate. It is a part of a family of companies. It's its own publicly traded company, but it was launched, I believe, as an offshoot from Realtor.com. Anyway, a bunch of people went over there and they started Move.com, and it's a real estate related website. And Move.com got held hostage this week. Cyber criminals who are getting better and better at circumventing firewalls and antivirus programs, more of them are resorting to ransomware, according to the New York Times today. And what happens with ransomware is that encrypted computer data, it encrypts computer data, so this is like a Trojan horse. It comes into your system, and then it holds it hostage until a fee is paid. And that's what happened, is that Move.com basically was held hostage for a cash ransom. Unbelievable. And so the virus-loaded ads that go into legitimate websites enable them to remotely wipe a hard drive clean or cause it to overheat. And there is concern that a lot of these kinds of companies are being, that are doing this, are being sponsored by the governments of Iran and China. So it just gets like all 24. I mean, just wow, really kind of crazy. And so the FBI and international law enforcement agencies teamed up earlier this month to kill one ransomware program called CryptoLocker, which you probably had heard of, and it had infected 300,000 computers and was spreading rapidly, right? So they were teaming up. Now comes this Move.com, which basically ground to a halt. And so what happened was, well, the official name for it is Distributed Denial of Service, DDoS cyber attack. And while the sites are now back up and running, this was as of yesterday, I think, they're a little bit slower than usual, and the company is trying to bring the sites back to a full recovery and assure its customers that this is not going to happen again. I mean, this kind of stuff has gotten to be huge business, and hackers continue to find new ways to disrupt what's going on, the commerce of the Internet, and all of us are vulnerable. We're vulnerable with our identities. That's why identity theft protection programs and checking your credit has become just something you absolutely have to do all the time. It's no way around it. Monitoring your credit has become a better and better idea. There is no such thing as a free lunch. So the sites that you see that are saying, oh, we'll let you check your credit for nothing, it's not like going to annualcreditreport.com, which is truly the only place that you get your credit report for free once a year from each of the three credit reporting bureaus. And I think now, and I say this, and I am the managing editor for the Equifax Finance blog, so I'm really inside it. I'm watching what's going on, and we're reporting on it, and reporting for identityprotection.com, which is another sort of ID theft website where we do the news for it that's owned by Equifax. But I'm watching the stories that we're covering, and I'm thinking to myself, man, this is my own virus protection software updated? So we went through the whole company in the last 3 weeks, making sure that every single computer is updated, and we found some minor malware on one of our computers. It's just, you gotta stay vigilant. You gotta protect yourself as best you can. There's no way around it. So I thought that whole idea that you're gonna, take down a website and then hold it hostage, right, especially in the real estate world, absolutely fascinating. And it's hard to even imagine, really hard to even imagine where this is just going to. Anyway, back to Morningstar for a minute, this little digression there. But what was interesting about Morningstar this week, one of the things that I thought was really worthy of conversation is this idea that retirement is changing for people who are boomers. And some of the ways that people are now thinking about this are, you've got different chunks of what makes up your retirement financial portfolio. And I don't just mean the stocks and bonds and ETFs that you have. There's human capital, right? The, who you are, how long you keep working, what you personally can bring to the table in terms of money, income through retirement, right? So a lot of seniors are forced to retire, but then they go and they do something else, or they start a little business in their kitchen or whatever it is. So human capital. Then you've got the pension capital, and by that we mean real pensions, which are now pretty much over and done with. I mean, people who are seniors now have them, but young people certainly don't. I think I have one true pension that is going to come from the radio and television union that I had to join years ago when I joined WGN-TV. I think it's going to amount to about $100 a month, but whatever. And then you've got sort of 401k money, so your investment capital, and you've got Social Security. And so you kind of look at these different chunks of money and how that is going to change throughout maybe 30 or 40 years in retirement. The latest thinking is that kids born today have a 50-50 chance of easily getting to 100, and many are going to live to be 120. That's insane. So if you have to retire at 65 and you got to get all the way to 110 or 120, that is a lot of years in retirement. So the way that people are thinking about this is just is shifting. And I've got some ideas about how to think about it and how to plan for it. And on the other side, what's going to complicate it, and this is something else I've been thinking about this week, is that young people in their 20s, if they even get jobs that offer 401ks, they don't end up staying there long enough to take advantage of it. Because young people switch jobs every year and a half to 2 years, especially in their 20s and into their 30s, and there's no real stability. And so I think that's going to have a profound and is yet untalked about effect on their retirement. 404-872-0750. Lots to talk about today on the Elyse Glink Show. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Call in now with your questions. I'm Elyse Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 1124 on the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours in WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online, on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Join the conversation. It's already in progress. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com. Lynn joins me on the line from Marietta. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon. I have a question concerning some real estate that I own in Western North Carolina.
Okay.
It's about 40 acres. It's in a fairly depressed area in terms of the economy. Most of it's pasture and things of that nature. And I've had it listed for several years with a local real estate person that I like, but nothing's happening. And I wonder from time to time, is there anything that I could personally do to help maybe encourage the sale of this property, list it different ways? Would it be better to list it in a big city like Atlanta? Or if you had any thoughts on that.
So the thing is, Lynn, that property these days is found globally. But you have to take to the internet to make that happen. And there are some things that you can do to juice this, right? What you want to do is consider how you're going to get the most number of eyes who would be interested in buying this property on the property listing. So the first thing to do is evaluate where your agent is listing the property. If she's only listing it in your local paper and it's not online and not with Move.com and not with Realtor.com and not listed on Zillow, Trulia, and all these other places that are now huge, huge eyeballs are there, then you're really missing out. So that's one thing. You can also set up your own inexpensive website for it with the actual property address, and put up all kinds of photos of the property so that people understand what they're getting at. And you can write copy about the property that is layered with keywords that people are looking for. That's another way to get eyeballs on it.
Okay.
A third thing you can do, and I encourage you to think about this, is to consider auctioning off the property. So what's happened is the companies like Auction.com, which Google just invested $50 million in, I think, Auction.com is selling billions of dollars of property every month, and they are working with real estate agents. So it's not like you're not going to work with your real estate agent. But what auctioning your property does is it blasts out to the market so that all the people who are interested in seeing that property, become aware of it, and there's a timeline. And once you have a timeline attached to something like this, it is much more likely that you're going to sell the property. And you can always have a situation where, you know, there's a minimum level and it pulls off, but you've had it listed all this time. It's time to sell. But if you're going to sell, you're going to have to get serious about it, auctioning it, and there's a number of different auction companies you can use, but you want the biggest number of eyeballs possible, and you want to think about who is the market for this property and why it hasn't sold, and are you willing to get rid of it at any price? So there's some work you have to do looking in the mirror, right, as we all do when we're selling a huge asset, and then you've got to do some work to figure out how you're going to maximize the eyeballs on that property so that you actually unload it and get to rebuild and move on with your life. Thanks for listening. 27 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Klink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
It's 11:35 on the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, the number 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to check out Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. All right, let's go back to the phones, 404-872-0750. Sue joins me on the line. Hey, Sue, happy Sunday.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm trying to make it. I have a...
Whoa, you're trying to make it? That doesn't sound too good. What's going on with you?
I know. In the middle of all of this heat, I got to deal with a real estate problem.
Uh-oh.
My mother died recently, and I had bought a loan for her to live in a house.
Okay.
In the meantime,
when you got the loan, did you actually buy the house for her, or she bought the house?
I satisfied the loan with my credit. She did not buy the house because she couldn't.
So you bought the house, and you were on the loan.
Yes.
Okay.
She was on the loan because she lived in the house.
Okay.
She died at 92 years old a few months ago, and I miss her terribly.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm sure you do.
However, I had to refurbish a lot of the house to get a tenant so that I could pay the mortgage because I'd lost my job.
Okay.
Now, in the meantime, the tenants love the spot so well, they want to buy it.
Okay, that's
nice.
They have
secured, tried to secure a loan so that they can take over the house. However, I have two sisters on the deed that I didn't find out about until about 15 years ago. I have 3.5 more years to pay on the house, and they're trying to say that they can block me.
Okay, so let me just ask you a couple of questions. You didn't, because the way you said it, I wasn't quite sure. There are two sisters you never knew about who are on the deed?
I didn't know their name was on the warranty deed.
How did that happen if you bought this house?
Because 6 months prior to me signing for the loan, my mother and two other sisters found the house. I wasn't supposed to know anything about it, but after they couldn't get it, they had already signed their names on papers that I wasn't aware that ruled. I was only 35 at the time.
How many years ago was this?
27 years ago, 28 right now.
But when you got the mortgage on the property, didn't it turn up who was on the deed?
Yeah, but I never looked at it because I was busy living my young life. 15 years later, I found out that
that's
the warranty deed.
Okay, that was a pretty big mistake on your part.
I know.
So what is it about your sisters? Are they angry at you for some reason? Because it sounds like they should be grateful to you.
Well, that's what everybody thinks, because the one who got me to sign on the loan was a real estate agent at the time in another city. So she knew all of the ins and outs of what a loan would do for the warranty deed, but she never told me. I didn't know that.
Uh-huh. And
now,
you didn't have any, you relied on your sister to deal fairly with you and give you good
right.
advice, and she double-dealed, and
right.
she clearly doesn't care about you.
Oh, well, yes. So should I let the house go back? Should I get the tenants out? I'm just lost.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. Since you've made all the, first thing you're going to have to do is get a lawyer. When the house gets sold to the tenants, the first thing that'll have to happen is you're going to have to be repaid for all the money you've invested in this property over the years, which includes all of the interest paid plus the principal on the mortgage. So that's the first thing that's going to happen. And then you're going to be reimbursed for the upkeep on it. And anything that's left in the house can be divided by three. And that's
right.
what's going to happen.
And I've drawn up a contract.
You personally have drawn up a contract?
Yeah, and said that
Sue,
I was there.
Sue, let me stop you right there.
Mm-hmm.
I would think after all the problems that you've just described to me legally, of how you didn't go get help, professional help the first time, and look where you've ended up, that the last thing you would do is draw up your own contract. Are you a lawyer?
Well, no, but I got advice from a lawyer and through the credit company that this couple are trying to get the loan from, and they told me if I had the loan to just write it up, get it notarized, and that's what I did.
You got what notarized?
The contract that I would be willing to sell the house to the tenants that are in it. But I also let them know that there are two other people on the deed.
Sue, this isn't going to fly. You need real professional help. I don't know what I can say to you. You don't want to go down this path without a real estate attorney by your side fending off your sisters. You already know them to be double dealing and not treating you fairly for all of these years. Now your mother's died. I don't know what her estate is like. I don't know who's managing the estate, but you're managing it. They don't seem to like you much.
Well, I know that.
So why are you not, you need a real estate attorney who's going to say to them, hey, we're totally happy to give you your share after my client has been reimbursed for all the money she's put into the property, for the mortgage, and for the updates that had to be done to the house. This house is getting sold, and when it's sold, if anything's left, it'll be divided by three. Not that you deserve it, but legally that's what you're entitled to. But first, she's getting all of her money back. But you need a legal person on your side to fight this battle for you, Sue. You cannot do it yourself.
All right.
I mean it. It's not enough. It's nice that you got advice from a lawyer, but unless you, even if you told me you were a lawyer, I would say to you, only a lawyer would have themselves as a client, only a fool for a lawyer. And what you're doing now is you are putting yourself into the position of getting taken advantage of all over again.
Right.
And you've lived with this hurt for 20 years.
Yes, I did it. I'm almost 70 years old. I've done that since I was 35.
I feel so bad for you, and I'm giving you some tough love here because I think you've been so badly taken advantage of by the people in your life that you should have been closest to, your mother and your sisters.
Right.
The fact that they kept this from you all these years and that you weren't able to, you didn't find out about it, you stepped up to the plate and you've gotten bashed on the hand over and over again, and you are setting yourself up for this one more time.
Thank you so much. I was trying to settle with them equally.
What? Fine. Settle with them equally, but you get reimbursed for all the money that you put in first. Any court in the land will stand up behind that.
Thank you so much.
You have to take hold of what is rightfully yours, and you need to make sure that you come first. Stop putting anybody else in front of your needs here. You put yourself first, you step forward, you get the help you need, and you tell them to sit down and shut up.
Thank you.
You got it in you. I know you do, Sue.
Thank you.
Will you let me know what happens?
I shall.
I'm sending you a big hug through the radio today.
God bless. Thank you.
All right. Have a good afternoon, and let
Thank
me know
you.
What happens. 43 minutes past the hour. Man, that just burns me up. For 35 years, Sue has been stomped on by members of her own family. It's disgusting. And she's put herself in the position to have it happen all over again. And I want that madness to stop for her. She's too nice a lady. You can hear it in her voice. She thinks she's doing the right thing. You got to actually step forward and protect what's yours. And in this case, it's her credit. It's the money she's put in. And frankly, it's the fact that she's now the executor of her mother's estate. She should pay herself an executor fee, which she probably legally is entitled to. It's in almost every will, and most family members don't do it. In this case, she absolutely should. 44 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Carl joins me on the line. Hi, Carl.
Lise, hey, I love the way you deal with callers like that. That's a special skill you have.
Thank you. How can I help you today?
Well, let's see. My mom has four kids. I'm one of the kids. She has put the house, she says, in her name. However, she still owes on the mortgage and probably has a second mortgage on it. And I'm told that you have to wait 5 years before that can protect her from creditors going after Medicare going after her house and that kind of thing. And
Medicaid.
Medicaid.
Right. That's different.
Okay. I just wondered if that, the fact that she owes on the mortgage, would that preclude her from being able to deed the house over to us?
Well, probably.
Hmm.
The real question is, what is it you're trying to protect? Because if she has a mortgage and a second mortgage, is she underwater with this house?
No, she's actually still working and she's not underwater. You
know. Okay. How much equity is in the house?
She's got about $50,000. It's only worth about $120,000.
Okay. So, and that's with the two mortgages, right? So the two mortgages together are about $70,000?
Right.
So here's the deal. If she puts the house in your names, you guys will, it's like she's given it to you, and there could be a tax implication if it's not done correctly. And then, it would be much better for you guys to inherit it, because, of course, you're going to inherit it at the current market value. But if she puts it in your names, or she creates a trust, which might be a better way to do it, and she just gets it out of her estate, then you guys can all be beneficiaries of the trust, but she still owns and controls it, and even the trust may impact the mortgage, but maybe not. So a couple of things to think about, because if she just gives it to you, she's probably in violation of that mortgage, and you don't want that to happen, just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand you trying to protect whatever equity is in there, but do you think she's going to need Medicaid?
Well, it's a long story. When my dad dies, and they're not together anymore, she does get a stepped up to his pension, so she'll be better off at that point. Yeah. So I would say no.
Okay. So then this is kind of an irrelevant thing because you're not really protecting it from anything. And if she is going to be on Medicare, and you know, just like when she turned 65, is she 65 yet?
She's 80.
Oh, she's 80, and she's still working.
But she's a fire plug. She's something.
Oh man, more power to her.
Yes.
That's awesome. When she gets to a place where she no longer, and at 80, she's already taking Social Security as well, right?
She started too early at 62. Yeah.
Oh, at 62. Okay. Well, but she's getting Social Security. She's working. There's going to be some more money from your dad's pension. When the time comes that she no longer can help herself, have you guys thought about what that looks like? Is she going to sell the house and then move in with one of her four children? Is she going to go into a home? What's going to happen?
First step would be to move in with her son who lives up there where she lives.
And okay. Your brother?
My brother, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, and I guess the rest of you guys would help contribute to the care of your mom?
Yeah, more so them because they're located next to her. I'm not so, but.
Right.
Yeah, we have to meet on that.
Okay, so I think you guys should all have a conversation with your mom about what she has, what she owes, and what the plan is going to be if and when it ever gets to that place. And I hope it really doesn't. But since it's not really a Medicaid issue, right? She's going to be on Medicare and she'll need to pay the Part B's and all that kind of stuff. But my guess is your mom's going to stay in this house for a while.
Yeah, so just one quickie. If she's already done it, can it be undone?
That she's given it to you?
Well, if it's already deeded over legally.
She can, did it get filed?
I got to find out. I don't know.
Okay. Well, it can be undone. I would just make sure you talk to an estate attorney, and it would be a good idea anyway, with your mom being at 80, to have an estate attorney look over her last will to make sure if there needs to be a trust, there is one, to make sure that the documents, either they're filed and filed correctly or they're rescinded, that all of the documentation is in place, and it's a good opportunity at that point in time for you and your siblings to sit together and just try and have a conversation about what's going to happen with mom and how everybody's going to contribute to that or not contribute to it. But it's better to know now and have your mom be a part of this conversation so you can all hear for yourself what her wishes are.
Great.
And I think having that conversation is hard, but it's a lot easier with a bottle of wine or a bottle of beer and some cookies.
Yeah, I got you.
All right?
I will do some cooking. All right.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks.
It is 404-872-0750. It is 49 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
It's 55 minutes past the hour, 11:55 on WSB. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You know, what last week we had Gary Zimmerman on the air for MaxMyInterest.com. And when I get these questions, I always say, well, you know, the question I usually get is, what do I do with all the cash that I have? And I have all this cash, and what, you know, where do I get the most money for my cash? And one of the things that I learned at the Morningstar conference this week, well, I knew this anyway, but it was reiterated over and over again, is that, frankly, if you've got cash in most places, you're actually losing money on it, technically losing money on it. And that's because the interest rate that you're getting is so low. And in some cases, if you've got money in, say, a mutual fund, right, and it's in the cash while you're waiting to invest it in something, because you may think that the stock prices are a little bit high, you may actually be technically losing money on it. And when hedge funds are trying to invest money and they've got all this cash on hand right now and nowhere to invest it, they're losing money. And so some of the people who were listening to the show last week sent me emails saying, MaxMyInterest.com is a really interesting idea. How do we get in? And so what we did, it's MaxMyInterest.com, as Gary explained last week, was his idea for how to maximize the value of cash. Because when you are, you know, in a bank account, what often happens is you see a bank and a bank is saying, oh, we'll give you 0.6% on your cash or 0.8%. And then you get there and you get that for a little while. You put all your cash in there. And then once they hit a certain level, they magically, that introductory rate disappears. And so now you go down to back to 0.25%. MaxMyInterest.com is Gary's idea for an answer to that, which is 5 online banks, all of which are offering really good rates, and then the program, the company, automatically shifts your money between the banks to maximize the interest that you're getting. Makes it super easy. Right now you need a code to actually get into the site, and the code that he set up for all you guys is WSB Radio, so it would be easy to remember. But that's the answer to some people who have been asking me this week, who's that cash guy? The cash guy, his name is Gary Zimmerman, and the website is MaxMyInterest.com. It's 58 minutes past the hour. When we come back, we've got a whole bunch of calls on hand. A couple of lines still open, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I've also got some more information from the Morningstar Conference, which was held this week in Chicago. Stay tuned for more of the Elise Blake Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 6 minutes past the hour, our number, 404-872-0750, or you can always call 1-800-WSB-TALK. having a quick conversation on Twitter. It's at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. One of our listeners texted in or tweeted me and asked what the executor fee is and how is it based. And for a lot of people, this just depends on the estate or the family. If they charge, and again, I would never charge my family for this, and my husband who's done this, Sam, has done this any number of times. He's never charged the family, but some families really deserve to be charged, like Sue's family that we had last hour. And in that case, some people charge on an hourly basis, some take a flat fee. The pros who do this will either charge hourly, hundreds of dollars an hour, or on a percentage basis in some cases. So you have to talk around, talk to a bunch of people if you're going to hire somebody to do this. Or if you're doing it, you can start talking to estate attorneys or CPAs and other people who perform this function to get a sense of what kinds of fees are acceptable in your area. 404-872-0750. James joins me on the line. Hi, James.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well.
Good. How can I help you today?
I purchased a condo about a year ago, and when the deed was sent to the county for registration, they replied via mail that there was an error in the description of the condo.
Mm-hmm.
That the address of the condo did not match the unit number, and the unit number actually referred to a different unit in the same development.
Really?
The lawyer, I contacted the lawyer, but he's as yet not corrected this error.
Did you have your own lawyer, or was this the lawyer for the mortgage company, or did you contact the escrow agent, or who exactly did you contact?
He was the closing attorney hired by the previous owner.
Okay.
Well, actually recommended by the realtor, you know how that goes. And I paid cash for it, so there was not a mortgage company.
Okay. So the title agent or the closing, you're saying that there was a closing attorney but not a title company involved or an escrow company?
Correct. Not just a closing attorney.
Okay. So you called the closing attorney and the closing attorney has not been in touch?
Correct.
And is this guy a solo practitioner? There's nobody at the office?
Oh, no, it's his assistant answers, and I spoke with them, but no corrective action as yet.
Okay, and how long has this been going on?
About 2 months.
Okay, have you sent anything in writing?
No.
Okay, so here's what I think you ought to do. I think you ought to send the attorney a letter and say, "Dear closing attorney, on such and such date, you closed this property. You were supposed to make sure that the address of the property was correct, that the description that was sent and created in the deed was correct. Apparently it's wrong. I've been trying to reach you for 2 months. I will give you 2 more weeks to get this done, or I'm going to report you to the State Bar Association for malpractice." You'll certainly get his attention.
Okay.
And he will wake up and he will do something. Because it's because you are taking... You don't really want to report him to the Registration and Disciplinary Committee, but the problem is he's not being responsive, and maybe it's because he's super busy, and that's nice, but it's not nice for you.
Correct.
And so you need to wake him up and get his attention. So by putting it in writing, this, and having it delivered to his office, or you can send it by FedEx, so they have to sign for it.
Okay.
You know that he's received it. It's entirely, you have to always assume the worst, and so maybe it's possible that his assistant is completely incompetent and has not passed along the messages, and this way you're going to be sure. So,
the assistant did verify that they had 2 pieces of information, one from the title search and one from another document that disagreed, and that some other, so apparently they got this mismatch information from sources, and they just passed it on without realizing or noting that the two did not match. So she admitted there was an error.
Okay,
and that's as far as it got.
Great. So you can put all of that into your letter to the attorney. You can put copies of the documents with it that they've sent you or that whatever you got, and just say, look, I'm giving you 2 weeks to get this fixed, and otherwise I'm going to report you because this is incorrect. You have not represented correctly. You've not done the work right. At that point, you may need to, if he still won't own up and do anything, you may actually have to report him, and then you're going to have to find your own attorney or title agent. I think a title agent ought to be able to help you, like an escrow agent. And you're going to have to pay somebody else to get that fixed.
So we agree that this posing attorney is, in fact, the person who should correct this error.
I believe so, because you're telling me there's nobody else involved with the deal.
Nobody but the seller and the buyer and the real estate agent.
Right. So the closing...
At least him.
Yeah, the closing attorney is the one who prepared all the documentation.
Right.
So they made a mistake.
Okay, then I have a next step, and thank you for your advice.
You're very welcome. I hope it goes well, James. 404-872-0750 on the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours. Jim joins me on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Elyse. I had a question. I've got three rental houses, and I've got a pretty large umbrella policy, but I'm wondering if I should form an LLC to protect myself a little bit more.
So what are you concerned about with the LLC?
My wife and I have some considerable assets, and we're just worried about getting sued, basically.
Okay. And how much is your liability policy for?
I called you about 2 years ago, and you recommended I do, twice our assets. So it's up around 2.5, I think.
So I would say to you that that's probably... Maybe that's enough, or you could go a little bit higher.
Okay.
But will an
LLC really give me any protection, I'm guessing not.
It does and it doesn't, right? So let's assume you open up an LLC, limited liability company, and you transfer the assets into it, right? A lot of people make that mistake where they open it up and they don't ever title. You have to retitle all your assets. So now let's assume you do that. And let's assume the retitling doesn't cause problems with your lender if you have lenders on any of those houses. So
I've got a lender on one, but the homes are already in a trust.
The homes are in a trust?
Yeah.
Ah, so what kind of trust is it?
It's a, you have to ask any of them.
Just a regular trust?
Irrevocable trust.
Irrevocable trust. So you don't really own them anymore.
The trust does, yeah.
Right. So I think you've already taken steps to protect yourself.
Okay.
Because you wouldn't want to retitle. First of all, you technically can't retitle properties you don't own out of an irrevocable trust, which you've done for estate planning purposes, I assume.
That's correct.
Into an LLC because you don't own them anymore.
Okay.
Now, in terms of protection, I still think having a really good, anybody can sue anybody. So having a large liability policy is a really good idea. And having the correct insurance on the properties is really important as well. But the cash from those properties should be flowing into the trust anyway.
Right.
And then you pay for all the expenses and whatever out of the trust.
Correct.
So you technically don't own these properties, so the question is kind of moot.
Okay. That,
and now what we've done is we've saved you one more tax return at the end of the year.
Exactly.
Because I'm sure you're already doing one for the trust.
Yes, we are.
All right. Well, enjoy that.
All right. Thanks, Elyse.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jim. Glad it's working out for you. All right. 404-872-0750. Let's see if we can fit another call in. Lori joins me on the line from Tucker. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Elyse. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's going on?
Great. I have a question regarding if I can qualify as a first-time buyer again. I had originally purchased a house in Henry County about a while back, like 2000 or something.
Uh-huh.
And I had did a Chapter 13 in 2005. The house was immediately sold. I was going underwater and had some family hardship and what have you, so I had to get rid of the house. I didn't want to, but I had to. And so now I'm at a point in my life where I'm ready to purchase again next year.
Okay.
And I wanted to know, would I be qualified as a first-time buyer again, or do what I need to buy cash? Because I will have some enough cash saved to buy, like, maybe a, you know, like, no condo or something, but I will wanted a bungalow, a nice bungalow, one of those Tudor homes I saw in Spalding County. I would like to have one of those. And I want to, most likely, I would have to finance that one instead of the condo. I know, which I could probably just purchase outright.
Slow down a second. So, what is the concern about being a first-time buyer or not? What do you think is going to happen that's special if you're considered a first-time buyer?
I can get some of the perks.
Like?
The perks that I got the first time where I had, I can't remember everything my agent did, but there were some perks that I got, like extra down payment wasn't a lot, and some other things that she finagled into the purchase of the home that I can't recall.
Okay. So you're in your head worked up about being a first-time buyer for reasons you don't even remember, because you remember it being a good experience and the agent did something for you. So let me tell you how it works today. First of all, today's mortgage market is completely 100% a different animal than it was back in the year 2000 or even the year 2005.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely different. And what matters today is that you have really good credit, which, how is your credit?
It's good. It's not perfect, but it's good.
What number is it?
It's 5-something.
So if your credit is in the 500s...
Almost 6.
I got to tell you, you may not even qualify to buy a house.
Really?
Yeah. All right, we need to take a quick break. Can you stay with me, and we'll come back, and I'll walk you through what you need to do next?
Yes.
All right, hang on. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 23 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We've been talking to Lori. And Lori did a Chapter 13 in 2005. The house was sold. She's been fighting her way back. And she wants to buy a house next year, which is awesome, except that her credit right now is mired under 600. So, Lori, what's happened over the last couple of years since the housing market crisis hit and there was such a credit crunch is that lenders have swung all the way back to the other side. And it's really, really hard to get a loan even if you have a 620 or 650 credit score, let alone something in the fives.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that's still affecting your credit since 2005? Because 2005, that's 9 years ago, almost everything bad should have fallen off. And if you'd been, you know, towing the line with rebuilding your credit, it should be a little bit higher than that.
Well, that's the last time when I checked it. The last time I checked it, it could be higher now, but the last time I checked, there are a lot of things that's on there should not be on there. Like, I was injured in Walmart parking lot, and there's a medical bill on there because I've been going back and forth with the company to pay it, and they haven't paid that, so that's on there from Emory Hospital. There is a voluntary repo from Drive Time that I gave them back the car keys because the car kept breaking down on me. That's on there. And then some other medical bills and something that I've been disputing.
All right. So you're disputing all of that, and all of that is turning up on your credit, and it's depressing your credit. You'll have.
Oh, and then I have student loans.
Are you paying those on time?
I have went in default, but I'm getting back on track.
Okay. So the last time you checked your credit was when?
To be honest, it's been over a year, 2 years.
Okay. So you don't really know where your credit is?
No.
What I think you ought to do is go to annualcreditreport.com, and you should go pull a copy of your credit history from each of the credit reporting bureaus.
Mm-hmm.
And then pay the $9 and get your credit a score from one of the companies, maybe Equifax, and see where it really is and see what's being reported.
Okay.
And then you're going to need, over the next year, to spend a whole lot of time getting all that stuff cleaned up. You're going to have to figure out, get back on track with your payments with school loans, pay off or get rid of that bill from Emory, figure out, let some time go by with your voluntary repossession. All of those things that you've done really hurt your credit, and they're depressing your score. I want to see your credit history and credit score get to a place where you're at like a 670. And you've got a long way to go to get there. When, it doesn't mean you can't do it over the next year, but it means you got a lot of work to do. And you need to figure out how you're going to pack all that together, all that good work together, so that it pushes your credit score up, so that a big lender will agree to give you some of these incredible low interest rates. Because I'm afraid if you go now, you're not even going to qualify for a loan, even a first-time buyer loan, even an FHA first-time buyer loan. The answer to your original question is, you can be a first-time buyer because you haven't owned a house in the last 3 years. But the real relevant question is anybody going to lend you the money you need to buy the home of your dreams? And I would say, not yet. You got a long road to go to get there, but it's doable. If you figure out where you're starting from and where you need to be, you're going to figure out a way to get there. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Link. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more on WSB.
News 95.5 at AM 750, WSB.
36 minutes past the hour on the Elise Link Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750. I just talked about a website where it will automate the process of getting the most interest you can on your deposit cash. So you've got cash lying around, you don't know what to do with it. The website is called MaxMyInterest.com. MaxMyInterest.com. You need a code to get in. Gary Zimmerman was on our show last weekend. He talked about it. He's the founder of it. And he set up a code for our WSB radio listeners that is WSB Radio. So we made it super easy to get in. So WSB Radio, MaxMyInterest.com. If you are driving right now and can't write that down, go to my Twitter feed later on today, because I put it up there as well, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Then you'll be able to find it there as well. And I believe that show notes are up on the thinklink.com blog. You can go there from last week and find out all about Max My Interest and Gary Zimmerman as well. 404-872-0750. Zach joins me on the line from Midtown. Whoa, Zach, you there?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Elise.
Hi, Zach. How are you?
I'm doing well. So I had a quick question for you.
Okay.
I bought a condo number of last year. And while I was going through the process of buying, there were no parking signs on a 25-30 foot retaining wall. So I didn't think of anything of it. I'm a first time home buyer, so went through the whole process. Long story short, end of last year, a couple months after closing, the whole wall fell down.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
and where is the wall?
It's a retaining wall in the exterior, so none of the units were affected, but part of our parking lot is affected.
Okay.
So now they still don't have an exact number on how much it's going to cost, but they're thinking anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 per unit per condo.
Wow.
So the assessment is coming. Still hasn't been voted on by the HOA. But here's my question. At the time of closing, which was not disclosed to me, they knew that there was a structural issue with the wall. So my question is, and I know for sure that the sellers knew about the issue.
Uh-huh.
So my question is there any way to go after either the HOA or the sellers, since they knew that at least a $4,700 assessment was coming down the pipeline?
All right. So let's talk about what documentation you got and how this whole deal came about. Were you represented by a real estate agent?
I was not. I used the real estate agent of the seller.
So you were not represented by an agent. You used somebody. You used the seller's agent, who, so nobody was working on your behalf.
Correct.
Okay. Next question. Did they do a seller disclosure form?
They did.
And what does it say?
In the part that it says, is there any issue with the actual unit, the structure, is there any structural issues with the unit or the property, they actually checked, don't know. Which I know for sure that they did know that it was an issue because they, at some point they were on the board and all of the members of the HOA had gotten notices that there was going to be at least a $4,700 assessment.
Okay. So they lied on the form. Next question is, did you ask for the board minutes for the last 2 years and the board budget and the board projected budget?
My closing attorney did. If either my closing attorney did or the banker for the loan did.
He asked for the minutes and for the budget.
I want to say that he did, but I can't definitively answer that question.
And did you ever see any of that information?
I did not, but I did. I do know that the HOA claimed did not disclose that there was an assessment coming down the pipeline.
Uh huh.
I don't know if that helps, but
well. So when you get a building, the minutes of the meeting, what you're actually reading are for discussions like this. So you can now what you're going to do, now this is just going to be a big pain in the neck, okay, frankly, because what you're going to have to do is hire...
Well, it's an HOA, it always is.
Not even just the HOA. I mean, you have to hire an attorney who's going to request those documents. You can ask
right.
for them. And then the attorney's going to go to the seller's agents and the seller attorney and say, hey, you guys lied about this. You did know. It's not that you didn't know. You did know, and you've lied on this form. And when you lie on a seller disclosure form, that's a problem. So we think you should...
Even with the buyer's beware law?
Yeah. I mean, you can't knowingly lie. The problem for the buyer is that you have to prove that they knew or should have known about this material defect. You claim
right.
that you can prove that. You need
to because they sent out notices to everybody, and the HOA has told me that.
Right. So that's fine. So and they were on the board and whatever else, whatever the reason of proof is. So the first step is the attorney's going to gather all that information, and you're going
right.
to be paying for that on an hourly basis.
Right.
And then the attorney's going to write a letter to the sellers, and they're going to deny it. They're going to say, oh, we never saw that letter. If everybody got it, but we didn't get it. And now you're
right.
going to have to prove that they actually did get it and that they knew or they should have known. And that's where seller disclosure law is really tricky because the onus is on you to prove that, not on
right.
them to prove that they didn't know that. So then what's going to happen is they're going to offer, if they're good people, they'll offer to pay some, not all. And you're going to have to decide if it's worth it to you.
Right. And it could be just a big, long battle.
Right. Because... They're, you know, so it's $4,700 or $5,000, and they're going to offer you a couple of grand maybe, and you're going to say, fine, but at least then you won't spend yet another $2,000 or $4,000 on the attorney, or $10,000 or $15,000 to not get anything.
Right.
So
right.
your problem, and you made some mistakes here. You weren't represented. You didn't actually request the right documentation.
Right.
And you didn't read it. And so some of this onus, as I have to say, is on you because buyer beware is one thing. But actually taking steps to make sure you're as fully educated as possible is another.
Right. That makes total sense.
So I think if you guys can find a happy medium where you get some documentation together and you call the seller agent and say, hey, they must have known about this because everybody got a thing. And maybe you don't have to involve a lawyer to start out. But you just say, listen, I'm not asking for the whole thing, but I think they should probably pay half because I certainly would not have paid what I paid for this condo without it.
Right.
And
one last question, if we could just fit it in.
Sure.
So at the time of the sale, they knew that a $4,700 assessment was coming. Now they're projecting that it's a $10,000 assessment. Would you go after the $4,700 or would you try to go after all $10,000 and see if you'll meet in the middle somewhere?
I think you can just... What I would do is try to open up a conversation with them.
Right.
And say, look, you knew it was going to be $4,700. Now it may be as high as $10,000. What can you do to help me out here? And let them come back to you. And if you approach it more friendly than anything.
Right.
But I will tell you that if they were underwater when they sold, there's going to be no money. If they had.
They were not. I know for sure that they won't. They were. They moved to Texas. He's an air traffic controller now. So I know that they weren't in financial trouble when they left.
Okay. So you want to just open up the conversation. You
and
can
try to keep the lawyers out of it.
Yep, for the moment, and open it up with the real estate agent and say, you know, you sell a lot. You knew this was coming, or you should have known. It's the new you should have known. But to do it in a nice, non-threatening way and just say, look, I think it would be fair for them to contribute to this and just see where that goes. You can always escalate, but it's really hard to de-escalate.
Yeah, and then it's just more money down the drain that you might or might not come.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, you want to go sue them in small claims court for $5,000 or $10,000, you can do that. Now they're out of state, right? So that's a real big pain in the neck.
Yeah.
And you're going to be fronting that all on your own. At least in small claims court, it's just court costs. But then you have to actually understand how that process works, and they have to answer it, and then you have to collect on it. And, you know, it's not as easy as it sounds.
Right. Absolutely. Well, that's really helpful. And thank you so much, because the only process that I was having was I'm going to have to lawyer up, and it's going to be a big issue. So I think that's a wonderful first step for me, and I appreciate the help.
Good. Let me know how it goes, Zach, and I hope it goes really well. I really do. 404-872-0750 on the Elise Klink Show. Let's go to Barbara. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Hi, Elise. I need an appraiser.
Okay.
Not a real estate appraiser, but a personal property appraiser.
What do you have, artwork?
I have some prints that I have accumulated over the years. I'm 75 years old.
Uh-huh.
I am not on the Internet, so I don't have that resource to look anywhere. I also have some miscellaneous household objects like clocks, tools, collectibles, jewelry. I'm trying to get things in order so that my kids won't have to go through all this.
Okay. So do you have any kids who live nearby?
Yeah, they all live in the state of Georgia, yeah.
Okay. So I think... one of them should bring their laptop over, and they should give you a hand here with looking on the Internet before you hire a personal
property
appraiser.
Yeah, but I don't have Internet access. I don't have...
Right, but they'll have their phone. Their phones have Internet access. They may have an iPad. Their iPads may have Internet access or their tablets.
Right, okay.
Right? So you don't need to have a wireless system in your house for this to actually work for them.
Okay.
And then the other thing they can do is they can take some pictures of what you have. And then they can go home to their house and start researching it. And you can make it a big family project.
Is there an association of appraisers who are registered or something?
So there are, I think. So let's talk about the different pieces you have. If they're museum quality or prints that are, but the names that are museum quality, you can call.
I have signed, numbered prints that over the years that they have been given as gifts, or have acquired them at yard sales or in stores, you know, but I don't know if they're museum quality or not. That's
so
the problem.
You could call the local office of Christie's or Sotheby's. There are also a couple of other really nice auction companies in Atlanta, and you can talk to them about who you have, whose stuff you have, and if that's something that their appraisers would be interested in looking at, along with some jewelry that you have.
Okay.
And you can do that. In terms of a personal property appraiser, I'd have to look online. I'm pretty sure there is a nonprofit trade association. There seems to be one for absolutely everything in the universe.
Okay.
But I also think that you might want to talk to your kids about having them help you out with some research so at least you know what you've got or what you think you've got before you hire somebody to come in and do it. And that's really one of the beautiful things about the Internet is that it's incredibly helpful for this kind of stuff. And it does give you a sense of whether you're dealing with something that's worth $1,000 or $100,000. And wouldn't it be exciting if it was worth more than that? And then from there, I think you'll be able to be led to experts in the area because you have different kinds of things. You've got jewelry and you've got artwork and you've, you know, different knickknacks and things like that. it may not even be just one person. It may be a series of people, and maybe the right person will be from a gallery that represents different kinds of pieces like that, rather, or an auction company, rather than even a personal appraisal. But I will take some time over the commercial break, which I have to go to right now, and I'll look it up and see if I can find somebody. So hang on. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
So Barbara has some artwork, jewelry, knickknacks, and other cool stuff in her house, and no internet access. She wants to know what it's worth, and she wanted to find an appraiser. Not a real property appraiser, but a personal property appraiser. So, online during the commercial, I found the American Society of Appraisers, which is the oldest appraisal society in the U.S., and they have been training professional appraisers since 1936. And so they claim to be, and I have not verified this, the only multidisciplinary appraisal society, and they work on all kinds of property, real property, personal property, tangible and intangible. So you can go to appraisers.org, appraisers.org, and you can look at some of the information they have online, and they have a place that helps you find an appraiser. Talks about the accreditation process and all the rest. So there you go. There's somebody that you can call. But I still agree, I still think it's a better idea to talk to her kids and have them do some of this work online, and at least then they can start to evaluate who these appraisers are that she calls, because you really need that kind of internet access to be able to figure out this kind of stuff. 56 minutes past the hour. Steve joins me on the line from Woodstock. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Elise, how are you today? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Elise, I know we're short on time, so I'll be as concise as possible. I have a very dear friend who is responsible for overseeing a trust that was set up by her uncle for his disabled son.
Uh-huh.
There was no cash to go into the trust. The trust will be funded by the sale of property, which will net them about $430,000 after commissions and what have you. My question is, they will have to obviously have another place to live. My question, twofold. Number one, do you recommend paying cash for a home, or would you recommend a mortgage so that they can invest that money to produce long-term income for the disabled?
I think when you have a child who's disabled, then what you want to do is you want to have as much safe and secure safety and security around that child as possible. And so you really need to have somebody go through all the numbers and have you figure out what it's going to take for that child to live. Is that child better off in a rental than an ownership situation? Is an ownership situation where you're locking in property price going to be the best thing of all? Can you do it? What does it look like if you do it with a mortgage, without a mortgage? So I think that we don't have enough time, because you're already hearing the music, to go through all of that. But I do think you need either an attorney or a CPA to run a whole bunch of different programs so that you can see exactly where that money comes out and what happens when it disappears entirely, and try and plan in some way, shape, or form for the future. So let me know what happens. I hope it goes well. And you can always call back next week to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Starting with yours, I will be back in the seat next week and online all the way through. Have a good week, everybody.